Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner, and you're listening to The Mark Steiner Show right here on Baltimore's home for cool jazz and more. WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And we're continuing our special broadcast in conjunction with The Daily Record and WEAA, coming to you nearly live from Annapolis. We recorded this earlier this morning at the Governor Calvert House. As you're listening, I'd love to hear your thoughts on what our elected officials have been saying about the issues that matter to you. You can tweet me at Mark Steiner or email me at talk@steinershow.org. A reminder that these issues and your comments will be the basis of our coverage of the legislature this year. Last hour, we heard from our new governor and attorney general. By the way, if you missed those interviews, you can hear them again at steinershow.org. This hour coming up, we'll talk to two of Maryland's most powerful men, Senate President Mike Miller and House Speaker Michael Bush.
Political question first, if you don't mind. You don't mind a political question, do you? I don't think so. So I'm curious, given what just where we are now in the state legislature with Governor Hogan in office, and what do you both think about what happened this last election in terms of the change? We're going to see a lot of kind of tensions around the budget, which we'll talk about in a moment. But you've been both been Democratic Party activists for your whole lives. I mean, right. How did the Democrats lose this election? I'm just your sense of that. I mean, it wasn't your race, but what do you think happened?
Anti-Obama feeling. It was, you know, the economy. James Carville, you know, put on the board, it's the economy, stupid. And the Democrats lost the Reagan Democrats. That combined with Obama's negatives and people staying home.
Mr. Speaker, one of the things that did occur, and I think Mike Miller just said it, is that Democrats didn't come out in Prince George's County, Montgomery County, Charles County, Baltimore City. They didn't necessarily vote for Governor Hogan, but they didn't come out.
In essence, the president's right. We had to find somebody that appeals more to the middle class and motivate the voters that seem to take the initiatives to pass their benefit for granted.
So people vote their anger. They vote their prejudice. That's what drives them to the polls. Okay, people don't go to the polls to vote for somebody. They go to vote against somebody for the most part. And the people in the rural areas, the Democrats for the first time lost the Reagan Democrats. The Democrats in the state of Maryland lost the seniors by 20%. The Democrats lost the veterans. And when you did a poll and says, who do you can trust to strengthen the middle class? Who do you trust most to strengthen the working men and women? It broke even. And when Democrats lose that base, you're going to lose every time.
I asked that question for a reason, and I'm thinking about the session coming up. And there are very different visions about how to manage the state fiscally and what the budget should be and what should be spent and what shouldn't be spent. And so it seems like the governor and the Republicans think that don't think that some of these things are necessary and don't want to pay for them. And Democrats seem to want to pay for them, but Democrats can't even find a way to pay for them. Is that part of what's going on here?
What the people said, we'd rather vote for somebody we don't know than for somebody that we do know and has been governing for the past 8 years, and we're not happy with the way things are being. We're not happy the fact that we have to work two jobs. We're not happy that the federal government is sequestering. We're not happy that the federal government is furloughing. The problem that this governor chooses to ignore and everybody else seems to ignore is that Maryland is a company town. We're beholden to the federal government. Washington, D.C. was carved from my county in 1791. It surrounds it. 45,000 defense workers in Maryland were furloughed last year. They're going to cut 5,000 jobs from Fort Meade. They're going to cut 3,000 jobs from Aberdeen. That hasn't even happened yet. This is what's driving our economy down, and people are suffering. NASA, Goddard, NIH, Andrews, Pax River, Fort Meade, Aberdeen, the Weather Bureau, the Census Bureau, these people are being sequestered. They're being shut down. Their wages are stagnant. That's what's affecting Maryland's economy. It's affecting Virginia. Virginia has a $2 billion deficit. New Jersey's bonds have been downgraded. Pennsylvania's bonds have been downgraded. It's not the problem with any one politician. It's what the good news about Maryland's always been location, location, location. That's still the good news. But the problem is when the federal government hiccups, it affects the surrounding states.
So how does this budget, Mr. Speaker, that's being given to you both and your houses, address this? I mean, what is going to be the back and forth around this?
Well, first of all, I mean, we just got to see the budget last Friday, so we've had the budget for a week. Secondly, I think the same challenge, regardless whether you have a Democratic governor or a Republican governor, you had to find a way to mitigate the $800 million. Spending affordability, which is a committee that is a pretty conservative committee that is put together in the General Assembly, suggested that we reduce the structural budget deficit by 50% this year, 50% the following year. And that's structural deficit means the outgoing years and the budgetary deficit. This governor's budget, was put together by a group of people that obviously gave it to Governor Hogan. Governor Hogan, in his defense, has had limited time to really put together a team. But this budget tries to take all the structural deficit in 1 year, and it sacrifices the K-12 education system, in my estimation, and puts a tremendous amount of pressure on the professional workforce as well as the health care providers in the state of Maryland. So as we go through the budgetary process, the House has the budget first. We're going to look at ways to mitigate, particularly the cuts in K-12 education. We pride ourselves on having one of the best school systems. We're not going to sacrifice the education system of the students in the state and the families and the working class families that go to public schools. Regardless of what's proposed originally, we're going to make sure that we try to find every way we can to mitigate that.
Well, the governor says, and start with you, Mr. President, thank you, the speaker. The governor said these were not cuts in education. Were they cuts or not cuts?
I'll answer this. I mean, look, you cut to the baseline of 50%, which means when you cut the baseline 50%, it also gives you a lower starting point next year. There's a $40 million cut to education in Prince George's County. It goes directly to the school board. School boards cannot raise taxes or fees. You ask the county government whether they're going to make up the difference in those cuts to education, the answer is no. So school boards have to go back and find $40 million worth of cuts. Now, you have enhanced enrollment in all these school systems across the state. More and more people using the public school system. You have to have teachers to teach them. You have to have classroom space to teach them. You have to be able to pay for their benefits as far as their health care. You have to have the energy costs. All that is a cost of living adjustment that you go through. There's no way to mitigate $40 million in the education system in Prince George's County. They're estimating they'll cut close to 600 teachers to be able to accommodate that. That means bigger classroom size, fewer benefits for the educators in that area, and in my estimation, a slow erosion of your public education system, which we pride ourselves on. I'll finish with one last thing. He also caps the growth of education to 1%. When you cap that, it doesn't take into consideration the enrollment growth. We're expected to grow 1.8% over the next year. So if you continue to cap it, you continue to limit the ability for your K-12 education systems to do exactly what we want them to do, to flourish, and it puts us back in the same position we were when we had to pass Thornton. Somebody's going to take a lawsuit against the state, and you're going to be back in the same position you were before.
So if you agree with the speaker, Mr. President, what is the response?
I want to stop the campaigning. You know, the election's over. I'm the senior person here. I'm the old guy. You know, yeah, I've been through this with different governors, Republicans and Democrats and what have you. The election was over in November. You know, Martin O'Malley was a good governor. He was a very good governor. Did he vote for tax increases? Did he propose tax increases? I'm a fiscal conservative. I'm more conservative than most of my Democrat friends, okay? But I voted for all three of these taxes. Now, where the other 37 came from, I have no idea, because I didn't vote for them. I voted to increase the sales tax. But we're 47th out of 50 states in the use of our sales tax. You know, we don't tax pharmaceuticals, we don't tax food and things of that nature. I voted for the income tax to tax people like myself in the upper brackets, but for the majority of people are paying less taxes, and my family's in the alcohol business. I voted to raise the alcohol tax. You know, you tax yourselves. Those are the only three taxes I voted for in 8 years, the only three taxes I know we passed in the past 8 years. And they were good votes, they were good taxes, and taxes are the dues you pay to belong to society. And so we've had good government for the past 8 years. We're just a prisoner of the national economy.
So, let me go out to the audience and come back to put a little bit more about the budget, sir.
Don Rush from WSAL, Delmarva Public Radio. In terms of the Bay, we've been talking a lot about phosphorus. Those regulations have obviously been withdrawn. How do you see this governor and the state legislature dealing with pollution of the Bay and balancing that with, say, the interests of the agricultural community as well? I know that the number of folks, for instance, on the Eastern Shore that are representatives in the state legislature who said they don't want the Fossus regulations, strong opposition within your bodies to it. What do you see the future going forward in terms of this tension that obviously is developing?
There needs to be a more realistic solution. The proposal that was put forth, there was a lot of work, a lot of study into it, but it was pulled because what it was, it requires the farmers not to use manure to fertilize the crops, okay? What that meant was two things. One, that they were going to have to truck the fertilizer, or rather the manure, and it was going to be very expensive for them. And second, it meant that they were going to have to buy fertilizer from the stores and put it on the crops. So it was a huge expense, millions and millions of dollars on the farmers of the Eastern Shore. We weren't able to address that in last year, and that's the reason the governor delayed the study. He didn't have the results of the study that was satisfactory to the farmers and the advocates. Instead, he was going out of office, and he put the regulations in place, and there are still questions that need to be answered.
Well, I'm a little confused about that, and let you right back. But, I mean, go ahead, and I'll ask.
First of all, I mean, the rural areas, the real polluter was runoff from farms, agricultural products, and the question is, which is the best way to deal with that? Governor O'Malley put regulations in. Governor Logan pulled regulations. We've requested through a letter from the chairman of the Environmental and Transportation Committee the opportunity to sit down with the governor and see what direction he wants to take to find a common ground to deal with those phosphorus management tools, which we think are important to protect the bay. I mean, we're the stewards of the Chesapeake Bay, and I think that's a huge priority. Everybody ought to be invested in that, whether you're from Western Maryland, Eastern Shore, suburban or urban areas. And I just think that there's got to be some common ground we work to in that instance.
This is the point on this particular issue where I'm a little confused. We've been covering this for a long time, and you've been battling this for a long time in the state government. But it was my understanding that the phosphorus management tool, the scientists came up with it, all stakeholders were at the table,
right.
Farmers were at the table, Purdue was at the table, advocates and environmental advocates were at the table, and it was agreed upon. And it was also agreed upon that phosphorus is out of control, and somebody has to figure out that it was if I have this right, this $20-some million, the study said it was going to cost farmers, but 15.5 of that million was being subsidized by the state to farmers. So, I mean, why wasn't it regulated? Why wasn't it put in the very first time? I mean, what was it about what people came up with? It was supposed to be a collective decision that was wrong that caused it to fall backwards in the first place. And I also wondered what our outgoing governor made it pass the regulation, but I think he's a very bright man, and he knew that it would be in the register not long enough to be law, so Governor Hogan was going to say no. So, I mean, what really gives? What happened here?
Well, he thought it was going to become law. What happened is Governor Hogan pulled it so that it couldn't be printed. He was certainly entitled to do that, but Governor O'Malley thought that it was going to be law. But again, in fairness to the farmers and others, we have a $750 million deficit. There was no guarantee that they were going to be subsidized at $15.5 million. And they'd be left with the cost and in a non-competitive advantage with farmers in Delaware, Virginia, and North Carolina.
Back to the audience. Sure. Identify yourself and your question, please.
Hello, my name is Tyree Knight, and I attended Patterson High School in Baltimore City. I heard what Governor Hogan said about the budget increase in education, but I was wondering why he is taking down Baltimore City's and Prince George's budget down. But because at my school, I know we don't have like enough teachers and stuff like that, so our classes get overcrowded.
Good question.
In fairness to him, as he indicated, 80% of the budget is mandated. A large portion of the budget does not is this geographical cost of living index that benefits largely subdivisions that have single parents, that have students that English is a second language, and it's discretionary. When Governor Ehrlich came in to office, he wiped out the entire fund. This governor, he cut it in half. So in fairness to him, as he indicates, there's still growth, but not growth at the rate that the subdivision would like and what the General Assembly would like it to be. There's three branches of government. You're a student, executive, judicial, and legislative. The legislative branch is the policy-making branch. He has proposed his budget. We're going to take his budget and have public hearings, hear from people like yourself, hear from educators and otherwise, and we're going to try to restore those funds. We're going to try to reprioritize his budget, at the same time working with him collaboratively. So we thank you for your question.
I agree with that. Look, Governor Hogan puts his budget in. He has the right to put in any budget he wants. The legislature's job is to reset some of the priorities. I know in the House, the vast majority of people in the House are not happy with the cuts to K-12 education, and they will reprioritize those cuts and make sure that we mitigate as many of them as we possibly can. School system have adjusted to a full funding of GCI, so to them it comes as cuts, and we are going to do everything we can to make sure that boards of education, the families and kids that use the public school system are going to have the best opportunities to succeed with the revenues they need.
So how do you do that? I mean, what power do you have to change any of that?
Well, you find ways to find other funding in the budget or other cuts in the budget. That's how you do it.
We'll come back to the audience. Go ahead, ma'am.
Hi, good morning. My name is Stephanie Compton. I'm a Baltimore City resident, and I work with the Food and Water Watch. And I'm addressing the issue with the large poultry industries, like Purdue. It's my understanding that they own a lot of the profits, all of the profitable aspects of their business, but they leave the cost of the cleanup onto their contract growers. So I believe the contract farmers should not be responsible while these companies are reaping lion's share of their profits. So my question for both of you, will you support legislation to give farmers more negotiating power and more protections when they enter these contracts with the large companies like Purdue?
I don't know how you do that, quite frankly, but I would certainly consider it. But at the same time, we are in competition with Virginia, we're in competition with Delaware, we're in competition with North Carolina. We are a very small state. These states are on our borders, and we need to make certain that our farmers are continue to be competitive and that we continue to have people like Purdue, industries like Purdue, who also donate very generously to Salisbury University and other philanthropic endeavors on the Eastern Shore. We do not want Purdue to leave the state of Maryland.
Thank you.
Let's go back to the audience.
Hi, my name is Diamond Tate Brown. I'm the director of Out for Justice. Individuals with criminal records face significant challenges in obtaining employment. Records from years ago make it difficult for qualified workers to succeed. For the past 3 years, the Maryland General Assembly has considered legislation, like the Maryland Second Chance Act, that would shield certain nonviolent misdemeanor convictions after a period of time. Nationally, over 40 states have laws that restrict access to old records to allow folks to secure a second chance in life. Given the well-known impact that a state criminal record has on the ability to get a job, will the leadership support efforts to pass the Maryland Second Chance Act and to do something about records for charges that did not result in a conviction?
We're going to pass that bill. There's going to be restrictions on the bill, but we're going to pass that bill. But we're going to have major, major, major legislation come forward on reentry into society from prisons. So many of our prisons have become geriatric wards, you know, that we're housing people that don't need to be housed. We can get them out of prison, put them on Medicaid, so that the federal government is paying for their issues. But this is going to be a part of it. It's going to be a major effort on the part of Republicans and Democrats. And it's happened in 10 or 12 of our sister states, and we're going to move forward in that direction as well.
Thanks for your support.
Thank you.
We support that as well now.
So let me stay with you. Almost time for a break, is it not? We're about 2 minutes away. On a lot of people's minds, I think, before we go to our next question, I think we'll start after the break with, I asked you the question earlier, Mike Bush, about what can you really do? People, I think, are confused in many ways about when they see this budget being put forth with the cuts that are in it. What power do legislators in this kind of governor-dominated state, in some ways, politically, have to address the issues that you don't agree with? If you don't agree with the cuts that are taking place, how can you respond to it?
Well, here's the issue. I mean, there was a mandate from the people. I'm a politician. I believe in a democracy. The people spoke. The people spoke who came to the polls, and the people who didn't come to the polls spoke. Okay? And this governor, he's got a mandate. He really and truly does. A large segment of this room and your listening audience don't like it, but guess what? They lost an election day. Okay, so he has put forth his proposal. We are going to work with this governor, and we're going to fashion a budget that is more to the liking of Middle Maryland. Okay, but at the same time, we're going to work with him and understand why he did it and what he's doing. The only thing I would ask of him is to dial down the campaign rhetoric. The campaign is over. Now we've got to work together for 4 years. Come together, stay together, and work together for the benefit of the people. We have a very limited role to play in the budget process. In the early 1900s, the legislature bankrupted the state of Maryland with their free spending ways. And a commission was put together, headed up by the president of Johns Hopkins University, and said, this is the authority that we're going to give to the Maryland General Assembly. And the Maryland General Assembly accepted it. The people voted for it. It's in the Constitution. It's very limited, but we can transfer money. We can recognize the needs of the state and transfer money. We can't rate. If we want to put something in the budget, we've got to be able to fund it. I don't anticipate any new tax increases or fee increases, but we're going to reprioritize education. For example, this budget cuts community colleges. Who wants to cut community colleges? That's nonsensical. That's our first line of defense in a democracy. We're definitely going to restore those funds.
First of all, as a disclaimer, I wasn't here in 1900, neither was the president.
I don't know about that.
But obviously, I mean, the president of the Senate said, who wants to cut community college? Obviously, this administration wants to cut the community college. You know, and look, I think as you go through this, it's the legislator's job to find alternative methods to balance the budget and then work with the governor. Look, you have to work with the administration and the governor. You want to do that. But, you know, I remind you, bipartisanship is a two-way street. The governor got elected. He got a mandate from the people. But so did 141 delegates and 47 senators. And I think that they also want to represent their constituents and the way they promoted themselves during the election as well. So, I mean, the voice of 91 members of the opposite party in the House of Delegates is certainly going to have their say in the budgetary process.
You're listening to the 12th Annual Annapolis Summit, brought to you by The Mark Steiner Show, The Daily Record in WEAA, and sponsored by Stevenson University, Baltimore Gas and Electric, the Maryland State Education Association, the Center for a Livable Future, Alexander and Cleaver, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Senate President Mike Miller and House Speaker Michael Bush. So stay with us. Welcome back. This is Mark Steiner. This morning was the 12th Annual Annapolis Summit, which is coming to you now nearly live from the Governor Calvert House in Annapolis. The conversation was just recorded 2 hours ago. And here's the rest of my conversation with Senate President Mike Miller and House Speaker Michael Bush.
I'd like to kind of go back to some legislative issues. I mean, we've seen these cuts, and one of the things that a lot of localities are screaming about have to do with the money for roads that have been cut drastically over the last years in this legislation. And there are two parts to this. A, how do you resolve the needs of local governments for roads? And B, one of the arguments that the governor was making was that part of the problem is the money has been, and he didn't use the word stolen, but tantamount to taken out to use for other parts of the government, which is why it's empty, and we have to deal with the structural deficit.
Well, you know, he wasn't here, so he doesn't know, and what he's been told is not correct. What happens is that you allocate certain money for certain resources. So the money didn't come out of the Transportation Trust Fund. It just came out of the general fund to assist the counties with the road programs. Okay, but when it came to choice between roads and schools, the General Assembly chose schools. We fully funded schools and said to the counties, it's tough fiscal times. We're making cuts in the state, making cuts to the counties, and we're going to withhold
this appropriation for roads at this point in time to continue to fund schools?
The President's 100% accurate on that. Look, there's from the transportation funding sources, 75% goes to the Transportation Trust Fund, 25% is a grant program for highway user. But when you run a budget shortfall, your priority is education because that's a constitutional mandate. So Governor Ehrlich, Governor O'Malley transferred money from highway user fees into the general fund budget to make sure the education systems were funded across the state of Maryland. And let me just say this. Counties have been given quite a bit of taxing authority. We're the only state that gives counties the ability to raise their piggyback tax. They can raise it to 3.20%. I mean, the state's income tax is only 4.75. So they have plenty of revenue authority between the property tax, which is very low in this state compared to surrounding states, or the piggyback tax. And many counties have not utilized their own revenue sources to fill some of those needs that they have there and keep waiting for someone else, meaning the state, to cover the cost of those projects.
All right, we'll come back. Let me go to the audience next, please. Sir, your name and your question and thought.
Good morning. My name is Davon Love. I'm with an organization, an advocacy group in Baltimore called Leaders of a Beautiful Struggle. I have a two-part question. It revolves around the question of excessive force and police brutality. So the first part of my question, you know, there are a lot of advocates that are interested in expanding the authority of the Civilian Review Board and the disciplinary processes of law enforcement when there are allegations of police misconduct and excessive force, and amendments to the Law Enforcement Officer's Bill of Rights in order to create, you know, greater accountability measures for communities that are subject to what folks believe is police misconduct. Will you all support that in the legislature? Second part of my question, and this part's really important. I already know that police unions and Fraternal Order of Police have organized to impede the ability for some of these measures to get across. And I think what happens is that, you know, when folks talk about the issue of institutional racism, I think people think that we mean that there are these bigots that have these intentional motivations to go after, you know, people of color, instead of the fact that we live in a society that socializes people to attribute criminality to African-descended people. You know, I graduated from a predominantly white university in the state of Maryland. You know, there were insane amounts of drug use, and, you know, there wasn't the same level of policing, you know, in terms of folks being incarcerated, in terms of their interactions with law enforcement, as there are in communities that have the issue of police misconduct and police brutality. So my question, so the second part of my question, in terms of responding to the FOP and police unions' attempts to stopping, you know, these measures, you know, what would you say to them in terms of if you intend to support and to whatever degree you support these changes, what would you say in response to police unions that seem to think that criticism of law enforcement is an anti-law enforcement attitude, and try to get them to understand that we're talking about the communities most directly affected, having accountability measures to be able to address the issues that are prevalent in our communities?
I think we're going to look at it globally. For example, the mayor of Baltimore City and the head of the Baltimore City Council invited the FBI into Baltimore to look at Baltimore City policing particularly. Now, this is not just a Baltimore City issue, but it's an issue at Prince George's County. It's an issue on the Eastern Shore, and we're gonna look at it globally. We haven't been contacted by any police union or any law enforcement organization, so the issues are going to be before us, including both the criminal issues of criminal conduct and civil misconduct, and as well as the Bill of Rights. The Bill of Rights also applies to correctional officers, special police officers, municipal officers. And we're going to look at it and respond appropriately, including looking at body cameras.
Yeah, I tend to agree with the president once again. But, you know, that's why you have a hearing process in Annapolis. I don't know exactly what's in the legislation. I haven't been contacted by either side, quite candidly, in this debate. I know there will be legislation in. There will be legislation that's scheduled for a hearing. You get as much information as you can and hopefully make the appropriate decision to protect the general public as well as give law enforcement the tools they need to keep communities safe as well.
So, in talking about Ms. Love's question from the audience, was that I've run a number of town meetings around this issue on both sides, police officers there, communities there, and everybody else. And one of the big questions in this will be whether or not the Police Officers' Bill of Rights should be amended that allows, which would allow for greater power for civilian review boards to either indict or exonerate, as opposed to the process now where, I'm looking at the details of the process now, where officers have 10 days to wait before they before they can be questioned and et cetera. So I mean, that's going to be, I think, at the heart of this. Do you have particular positions on that? I mean, where
again,
do you stand on that?
That's criminal conduct. It's very different. If one of the issues is if an officer's out, there's allegation of criminal misconduct, they have to wait 10 days before they can inquire of it. And that's going to be a major issue that we're going to look at this session.
Do you have any positions or thoughts on it? I mean, directly how you feel about what should happen in this? You both are very powerful figures. I mean, you get a lot of what you want. I mean, so, but, you know.
For the most part, we let the information and the hearings guide us. I mean, I'm a non-lawyer, so I go in there and listen to the debate in the different committees and try to look at it from a layman's standpoint. There are plenty of lawyers that will be in the Judicial Proceedings Committee as well as the Appropriations Committee, and they'll articulate what the existing law is and what areas that need to be addressed, and I think that's the beauty of the legislative process, that everyone has a fair opportunity to come down and express their views. And I think in the final analysis, you'll see some legislation move forward, yes.
We try to be umpires. You know, we're given an inordinate amount of power, honestly and truly. We get to name the chairman of the committees. We name the members of the committees. We assign the bills to the committees. And so by just that virtue of that power that the Constitution gives us, the rulemaking body gives us, you have the power to decide what a bill is going to pass or fail. Okay, so what we do is we pick the best people to do the jobs, the best chairman, the best members. We look at race. We look at gender. We look at political philosophies. We look at geography. When we put these committees together and we assign the bills, and we listen to the committee members who have the hearings. We don't serve on the committees. Most of the times we don't attend the hearings. The bill's either brought to the floor or not brought to the floor, and then we're supposed to be independent arbiters. Now, occasionally we'll interject ourselves on an issue, but for the most part, we let the chairman, the members of the committees, decide whether the bill comes to the floor or not.
I mean, I know there'll be another bill coming in, at least I've heard it yesterday morning, coming, going into work, that a Baltimore County delegate is going to put in to have funds to put an armed police officer in every school in the city, in the state of Maryland. You heard about that one?
I saw this morning on TV about Baltimore City that has police officers in every school. They indicate that they carry guns. It's a loophole in the law that they want to try to close. It's been a debate that we've had before whether police officers going to have firearms in schools.
I mean, do we need armed guards in every school? I mean, there are horrible things that have happened.
I don't know that you need armed guards, but I can tell you this, that even in Anne Arundel County here, every high school and middle school has a police presence. And I think it's done a lot to deter any kind of violence within the school or any kind of outside individuals coming into the school. Now, I don't believe those officers are armed in any way, but their very presence has made a difference. You can go in front of every school in Anne Arundel County, high school or middle school, and see a police car sitting there, and it makes a difference. They also interact with the students and help with be a conduit to the administrators and the teachers in the school. So it's been very, very productive in my county to have the presence of Anne Arundel County police officers.
Let me go back to the audience here.
Hi, my name is Justice Rice. I'm from Patterson High School. Inequality in the United States and Maryland has been growing, especially racial inequality. What do you think should be the government priorities of this issue?
For growing inequality?
Yes.
Well, the creation of jobs. What we need to do is elevate persons who need jobs, jobs and opportunity, at the same time making certain that every student in Patterson graduates from high school. Too many students in Baltimore City particularly aren't in classroom every day. Too many students in Baltimore City do not graduate. And our studies show that 70% of those students who don't graduate at some point in time before they're 30 years of age are going to spend 1 year in prison. So we need to make sure that students are able to read by the third grade, they stay in school. We need to continue to provide the resources to make certain that happens.
But it seems the opposite is happening. I mean, I've seen the reports that say that in throughout the country and here in Maryland, that the public school population is increasingly coming from impoverished communities, no matter what community that is, and we're talking about taking money out of schools instead of putting it into schools.
In Prince George's County, we raised the graduation rate 2% this past year. So we think when we put resources in, we give the teachers the tools to do the job, we think we can make progress.
Look, I think the biggest initiative the state of Maryland has taken up in the last decade is the full funding of Thornton. It has catapulted our state into one of the premier public school systems in the country. Now, does that mean every school does extraordinarily well? No, there's great challenges, particularly in economically challenged communities. 25% of the population of Baltimore City lives at or below the national poverty rate. The national poverty rate is 15%. Baltimore City is 25% and growing. So in Baltimore City, there are special challenges. The essential needs in Baltimore City is access to a quality public education system, access to quality health care. All those things are necessary. And the president said it's 100% right. You need to have a way to make sure that those individuals have the ability to find a job and enter the workplace to have some upward mobility.
Now, I remember we started these conversations some 12 years ago. The debate and battle then, I remember in the early years of this Annapolis summit, was around the sales tax, whether to raise it, whether to broaden it. And that was a big fight in the state legislature a decade ago. And do you think that, and I'm semi-agnostic on this whole question of sales taxes because they can go in any different ways, and there's reasons to be for them and against them, but do you think that the inability to broaden the sales tax, perhaps raise it but broaden it, is part of the reason that we're facing the deficit today? I mean, that's why, when I said earlier that, you know, Republicans do want to cut and don't believe the government should do certain things, Democrats believe the government should do certain things but always have a hard time figuring out how to pay for it.
Two things. One, our economy shifted from a manufacturing economy to a service economy. So when I first started campaigning in 1962, a long time ago, we would have manufacturing plants to go to. We would have Sweetheart Cups in Baltimore. We'd have Bethlehem Steel, S&S Schwartz. And the candidate at that time I was working for was a Republican candidate for governor. And we would stand outside the factory gates, wait for the people to leave the factory gates. Now those jobs are overseas. So we've lost these manufacturing jobs. We have to find a way to bring some of those jobs back to the state of Maryland. And we can't get the votes to tax the service economy and get to the service area. And it's not going to happen anytime over the next 8 years. Or at least next 4 years, you've heard that. So it's sort of quandary. And the other issue is that so many of our sales now are over the Internet, right? Each and every one of us is guilty of this. Including myself. I buy historical artifacts over the Internet, and I buy books from Amazon and things of that nature. There's no sales tax, okay? So that's monies that are not coming to the coffers of the state of Maryland, but it's putting people in Maryland at a disadvantage, business at a disadvantage, because we're buying from somewhere else. So these are two major problems.
Mike Bush?
Look, the Internet sales have been a huge issue here in Maryland now. Christmas time, the retail sales are 3% in the stores, 9% on the Internet in an increase. It's unfair in two perspectives. One is that the small businessmen and to invest in mortar and bricks or rent a store or the malls, and you see many of these that are going out of business. Someone comes in their shop at Christmas time, looks at a piece of clothing, goes by and back, buys it off the Internet. It's not fair to the retailer. Number two is, we lose about $200 million a year in Internet sales tax. $200 million. That's the estimate that we have. But that's the changing economy. So in some respects, government has to change and look at whether its tax structure is fair, whether it's comprehensive, and whether it meets the needs of funding education. I would disagree with you on one aspect. I think Republicans want a good education system as well.
Well, I didn't say they didn't want it. I didn't say they didn't want it.
Okay.
Everybody wants that.
Well, I think everybody wants that. And you can't do it without funding. Make mistakes. I mean, make no mistake about it. Teachers are not overpaid. Administrators aren't overpaid. They put in a full day's work. And I think you have to come to some kind of grips with the idea that Better schools make better communities, and it certainly helps the value of your house, helps the value of your community, helps the value of everything that you have. One of the reasons that Howard County has the highest median income in the state, as far as I'm concerned, it's $106,000 to $109,000 a year. Spellers, you probably have the best public school system. People that have the means move up there to go there when they have 1,300 kids in their high schools, and I compare it to Anne Arundel, which has 2,000. People coming into the Fort Meade area, they're going to live in Howard County, work at Fort Meade in Anne Arundel County, or they're going to work in Anne Arundel County. If that takes place, the housing values in Anne Arundel County are going to plummet compared to the housing values in Howard County. So schools play a tremendous impact on everything that takes place in local government.
Back to the audience.
Thank you. Good morning. Morning. My name is Jen Brock Cancellieri. I work with the Maryland League of Conservation Voters. We all know that we're not actually taxing the rain, although this moniker seems to be here to stay. The fact is that counties have created local stormwater fee programs that are reducing toxic polluted runoff. I like healthy seafood, I like clean water, and I like the jobs that these programs are creating. Can we count on your leadership, President Miller and Speaker Bush, to work with us to ensure we don't go backwards on the progress Maryland's made to clean up our waters, and specifically that we don't let the counties off with their obligations so that the state is left to bear the cost of this cleanup?
We're not going to go backwards. There's going to be changes to the proposal. It's going to be funded. The only question is how it's going to be funded. But it's a federal mandate. It's going to continue in place. And whether the counties pay for it out of general funds or they want to create a special fee or what have you, this groundwater runoff that takes feces and fertilizers and all types of objects into the creeks, the streams, the bay, it's going to be stopped.
The irony to me in this legislation is it's probably the most sensationalized legislation that I've seen in quite a while. And I say that because we prepared for this for 2 years at the General Assembly, sat down with our partners in government, the Maryland Association of Counties, asked them that we had to meet this compliance with the federal government, the directive of the federal government. And they basically very strongly suggested that they have the opportunity to put in place their own funding source so they could collect the money and show the citizens they collected the money, they controlled the money, and they would control the projects. That was the overriding way that we implemented the bill. So every county chose the ability to deal with the stormwater management fee and meet the directives of the federal government. Look, I'm happy in Anne Arundel County where you have a Republican county executive who says regardless of what's going to take place, he's going to live with the program put forth by the county council last year to make sure stormwater management programs take place because he feels a responsibility to the Chesapeake Bay and its tributaries. I think every county should have that same type of commitment. So as we go forward, we're going to take a look at the legislation, make sure every county has a commitment to meet these directives. In 2017, when they come in and do a review of the stormwater management fee from the federal government, the stormwater management programs, that we'll be able to comply with the directive that they've put forward.
Maybe it was almost dead on arrival because when you have the politics of that and every county, state, and the city had a chance, Baltimore City had a chance to set their own fees, maybe that was its death knell from the beginning.
Well, the death knell was, you know, some slick politician came up and told people we were taxing the rain. People come up to the poll, y'all taxing rain here in the state of Maryland? Man, we ain't taxing rain.
Over here. So go ahead.
All right. Thank you. My name is Pip. I'm born in Maryland, and I identify as trans. So I was very happy earlier this week when Governor Hogan used executive order to rectify the absence of gender identity protections. However, he's also proposing a $200 million cut to Medicaid. So, do you believe that trans-inclusive protections should be extended to medical and employment protection? Where would you stand on legislation put before you? Thank you.
I thought that was a lot. I mean, we passed laws at on equal marriage. Went to the polling place. The public approved it. We passed laws banning transgender discrimination last year, and I didn't know that we allowed discrimination in that regard in any manner whatsoever. I'm happy to work with you and hear your concerns.
Yeah, I agree with the President of the Senate once again on this. I thought that, you know, Medicaid obviously is a public health care plan. And I thought once the law was passed last year that everybody qualified for the public health care plan that comes under Medicaid would be covered. So I have not seen that directive yet or legislation from the governor yet. But my understanding is that everyone should be covered under Medicaid. Now, I know the provider rates are being cut under Medicaid, but that shouldn't change the coverage.
Yeah, I mean, the Medicaid coverage is going to be another big battle the two of you are going to face in your houses. It's $200 million, do I have that right?
And for
women in their pregnancy, under right. $38,000 a year, $36,000 a year,
right.
No longer be covered?
Look, there are things that the governor has taken a look at and decided not to cover, and I think they're debatable, obviously, through policy initiatives. But the bigger thing in the Medicaid debate is that we've worked very hard to bring up provider rates to make sure that those that have the greatest needs, many times people don't have the wherewithal, will have providers participate in their communities. Once you start cutting the provider rates, you're going to find that fewer and fewer providers are going to go out and take Medicaid coverage. Now, a lot of people think this just affects Baltimore, but the places that are hurt the worst are Western Maryland and Eastern Shore, because there is not a provider network out there, and they will just stop, the MCOs will just stop providing coverage in those areas when they get their rates cut.
So final very quick question, because we're almost out of time.
Sorry. Hi, my name is Megan. I'm from the Rural News Network. So as Maryland experiences a deficit and there will be cuts in a number of different areas, how do you imagine that these cuts will affect low-income individuals and like the homeless and vulnerable populations like that? And how do you plan on supporting those groups of people, you know, as things are cut?
It's going to affect everybody. It's going to affect all Marylanders. And we're not up here trashing the new governor. He came into office. He's got a $750 million deficit, and he dealt with it the way he felt was best. He had two of my friends helping, the former county executive of Anne Arundel County and a former senator from Frederick County. And he said, well, look, I want to do this immediately. The General Assembly recommended he take 2 years to deal with it and slow these cuts down and hope that the economy would rise and to assist in those endeavors. But they chose to do it in 1 year, and that's where the resistance is coming from at this point in time.
Look, I think in everything down economy that those individuals that have the least economic means are the ones that are hurt the most with services that are provided by government. That's whether it's in Maryland, whether it's in any other state. So I think the people that depend on Medicaid are going to have tougher times. I think the people that have to utilize public education, and I don't say have to, I want them to think that we have a great public university system. Those who need to go to the community colleges, when those costs to community colleges go up, or those funding plans for K-12 education go down and puts more pressure on your school system, it's usually the communities that are challenged the most. I can tell you that the number of farm kids in Anne Arundel County, one of the wealthiest counties in the state and in the country, number on free and reduced meals has gone from 15,000 to 26,000 in less than 5 years. So it has had a tremendous impact, the recession. And, the one saving grace, I think, is the fact that we've had continued to fund education, had the courage to do that, and continued to fund Medicaid and had the courage to do that. And it's a question right now, or we debated with Governor Hogan. He certainly has the ability, as the President said, to bring in the budget he wants. But it's our job to point out that who suffers the most under the cuts.
The other thing that needs to be pointed out, this is the wealthiest state in the union. 50% of the students in the United States live in poverty. 50% of all the students in the United States live in poverty. Places like Arkansas and Alabama and Mississippi, like that. I mean, it's overwhelming majorities of the students live in poverty. We have a wonderful state. We have high income, and we have very low poverty. But these are problems that need to be addressed, and we're going to address them.
Just a reminder that the 12th Annual Annapolis Summit is brought to you by The Mark Steiner Show, Daily Record, and WEAA, and sponsored by Stevenson University, Baltimore Gas and Electric, Maryland State Education Association, the Center for a Livable Future, Alexander and Cleaver, and the Maryland Department of Housing and Community Development. We want to give big thanks to our elected officials, Governor Larry Hogan, Attorney General Brian Frosch, Senate President Mike Miller, and House Speaker Michael Bush for joining us this morning. And if you missed any part of today's broadcast, or if you want to share it with your friends and colleagues, you can listen to the podcast at steinershow.org. I also want to hear your thoughts on what you heard today. So please tweet me at Mark Steiner or email me at talk@steinershow.org. Thanks for listening. The Mark Steiner Show is a production of the Center for Emerging Media. Our producers are Mark Gunnery and Stephanie Mavronis. Our engineer is Andre Melton. To hear this show again, podcast past shows, and find out information about our guests and the work they do, please visit us on the web at steinershow.org. And you can also listen to and download our podcast on iTunes. For Public Radio, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community, I'm Mark Steiner. Take care.